Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. Coming up in this hour series, we'll be following storylines on The Man in the Iron Mask later on, firefighters, the adventures of Marco Polo as well. But first, episode 2 of 5 of The Valentine Matter on yours truly, Johnny Dollar. The CBS episode from the 1st of November, 1955.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
This is Charlie DeBaca down at headquarters. You left a call for me?
That's right, Inspector.
Thought you went back to Hartford. What now?
The company I represent happens to hold an insurance policy on Dan Valentine. They asked me to stay here in New Orleans and look into this attempt on his life.
How'd they hear about it so fast?
Well, it was in all the papers and on the wire services. Valentine's always been news, ever since Prohibition.
Yeah, a guy like him would be. Well, you know as much as I do, Dollar. No lead yet.
He's still quiet about the whole thing?
Just like a mouse who won't open up except to say he'll take care of it himself.
Maybe it'll help matters when he finds out the insurance company's interested.
You know something?
What?
I don't think me, you, the whole force, the insurance company, or anybody else can keep that bird alive unless he helps us.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account, submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the New Britain Mutual Insurance Company, Hartford, Connecticut. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Valentine matter. Expense account continued. Item 3, $3. One telegram to Roy Vickers in Hartford requesting a copy of the policy contracts between New Britain Mutual and Dan Valentine, plus the name and location of the beneficiary and any other debt on the case. After that, I walked over to the police station and looked up Inspector DeBaca.
Sit down.
Thanks.
I don't quite get this, Dollar. What's your part?
Well, the insurance company would like a full report on everything that's happened, that's all.
You could give them that on the back of your thumbnail, couldn't you?
Not quite, Inspector.
Oh, you mean a separate report from what we have?
Something like that, yes.
Well, it's their dough. They can spend it any way they want to, I guess.
If there's any reason for them canceling the policy on Valentine, they'll do it. The fact that somebody shot at him a couple of times and came near killing him is one thing. The fact that he won't open his mouth about it is another.
They're looking for a way out?
I didn't say that. They just want to make sure about everything, that's all. An insurance policy is a contract, mutually beneficial to both parties. Both parties have to keep the line of that contract.
They don't figure Danny Valentine would run around shooting himself for insurance money.
Inspector, they don't figure anything.
Well, now that you've been official, be unofficial. What's your idea?
Well, Valentine's got a legitimate policy with the company. They don't want to see him killed. They tell me to investigate the shooting. Actually, they're telling me to see to it that he stays alive and well.
Well, that makes sense. Good luck.
If you'll sort of let me tag along on the case, I'd appreciate it.
Well, we'll see.
Well, what's the matter now?
It just occurred to me. Valentine bought a house out in Jefferson Parish 3 months ago, a couple of days after he was released from a federal pen. He's lived there quiet, minding his own business, keeping his nose out of trouble.
Yeah.
Well, as long as a man does that, even a man with a background like Valentine's, as long as a man does that, we don't bother him, and he doesn't bother us.
Well, so?
So what happens? Yesterday, you meet him and have a couple of drinks with him. Hello, goodbye, boom, boom. He gets shot twice by somebody, somewhere. You a bad news boy?
Now, that's as wild as you can get. We had nothing together except the drinks.
You sure?
I'm sure.
Well, I'm thinking about it just the same. Here. Be back in a minute.
The bulky, thick folder Inspector DeBaca shoved across the desk at me was marked Valentine Daniel. It started in 1915 and was fat with yellowed clippings all the way through 1942. It was a pretty good history of Dan Valentine and the age he lived in. He was born in Ireland and had fought in the Irish Rebellion. He was regarded as both hero and scoundrel. For his own good, he came to America. Somehow, he started out in the wholesale drug business. And understandably, it was an easy step to making prohibition alcohol. And an even easier step to make prison on an income tax evasion charge. The folder mentioned a wife and a daughter who seemed to have successfully avoided most of the newspaper headlines that had involved Dan Valentine. There was one picture of Mrs. Valentine taken in 1928. That's about as far as I got when DeBacca came back into the room, not alone.
Interesting stuff?
Very, Inspector, very.
Well, here's something more interesting. My men have been covering the neighborhood where the shooting happened yesterday afternoon. This man's a witness. This is Mr. Dollar. He's an insurance investigator. It's Willie Blakely.
Oh, how do you do, sir?
Hope you can help us, Willie.
Well, I can try, I really didn't see too much. See, I was on my milk truck, and I saw this fella, this big fella, walking down the street. What's his name?
Dan Valentine.
Yes, sir. Well, he was just walking, like for an early morning walk, and then I saw this car come around the corner, and there were a couple of men in it.
What kind of car?
I think it was a Buick sedan. I'm not sure. It was a black car.
You happen to get the license number?
No.
All right, go on.
Well, sir, this Mr. Valentine, he looked up when he saw it coming, and he stopped. You know, kind of funny?
No, I don't know. Tell me.
You know, like he was surprised.
Do you think he was surprised at who was in the car?
Yes, sir, that's it. He sort of smiled. Not a hello kind of a smile.
Hmm?
Sort of a sad smile. Didn't wave, just stood there. I couldn't see the men in the car by then, so I don't know how they were looking at him.
Did you see them as they rounded the corner?
Yeah, just a couple of fellas, dark coats and hats.
Would you know them if you saw them again?
I don't think so, Captain.
Okay, two men.
Yes, sir. So this Mr. Valentine stopped and looked at him and gave him this kind of smile.
He recognized them, you think?
Oh, yeah. And then I heard a noise, you know, something like whack, whack. And Mr. Valentine fell down, and the car drove off.
Did Valentine go for a gun?
No, sir.
What did you do then?
Well, I got out of there.
Why?
I didn't know what was happening. I didn't want to get hurt.
You didn't even try to help him?
No, sir. I was scared. I didn't know what that whack-whack was, sir.
And it took you all this time to tell us about it.
Sorry, Captain.
Dollar.
Yeah?
You got something to worry about.
Hmm?
That noise he was talking about didn't sound like regular gunshots, or he would have said so.
Silencer.
What else?
Inspector DeBacca continued to question the witness, trying to ascertain more details about the shooting, the car, and the men inside the car. 4 hours later, when I left, he was still at it. Some more expenses. Item 4, $2.50, cab fare from police station to hospital. I thought I'd drop in and take a chance on Dan Valentine coming across with some information.
Sorry, no visitors.
It's pretty important. I'm a friend of his.
I'm sorry.
When can I see him?
That's hard to say. Mr. Valentine's condition is not too good.
What?
Well, nothing to be alarmed about. He lost so much blood that he's in a weakened condition. The doctor's ordered a transfusion.
Oh.
You can phone in later if you like. Excuse me. Yes, ma'am?
I should like to see Mr. Valentine, please.
I'm sorry. I was just telling this gentleman. That's impossible.
How is he?
He needs rest. The doctor feels he'd be better off without visitors at the moment.
Thank you.
I had a feeling about the gray-haired, well-dressed woman, and I hurried after her down the long corridor outside the hospital. I was just in time to see her take a cab that had been waiting at the curb. I managed to hail one myself, and we tagged along Canal Street behind her until she paid off the driver in front of the Roosevelt Hotel. I was right behind her when she stopped in the lobby and got a key to room 1016. I gave her 5 minutes, then I knocked on her door.
Yes?
Hello, Mrs. Valentine. My name's Johnny Dollar. Ann Valentine looked at me for a long time. I had to hand it to her. There were no tears, no frowns or screams. Just a wide, frank look from a woman who, by any man's standards, had once been beautiful.
I haven't been called by that name for many years. You're a reporter, of course.
No, I'm not. I'm an insurance investigator. In a policeman's office today, I saw one of the few pictures ever taken of you.
At this hotel, I'm registered under the name of Anne Ward.
Ward is good enough for me, Mrs. Valentine. May I come in?
Yes. Now, what is it you want, Mr. Dollar?
Possibly the same thing you want. To keep your husband alive.
I believe that's up to the doctors, isn't it?
Not quite. If he was shot at once and he won't help the police find out who did it, there's a reasonable chance he'll be shot at again. Do you know who did it? Well, who it might be. Look, the police have found a witness who describes two men as having done the shooting. Can you add anything to that?
Mr. Dollar, I haven't seen Dan in over 13 years. I haven't written to him, talked to him, or contacted him in any way, either while he was in prison or these last few months he's been out.
I see.
It was his idea.
But he must have had a reason.
He did. Our daughter.
Oh.
She believes that Ward was her dead father's name. Do I make myself clear?
Yeah.
I read about the shooting. I caught the first plane here because I thought I might help Dan. My daughter thinks I'm on a little vacation by myself. You don't believe me, do you?
Well, in view of what you've just said about not having written to him for 13 years...
That was the way he wanted it. I was never ashamed of Dan, never. He was ashamed of himself and how his activities might affect us. He gave me everything I ever had out of life. In New Salem, that's where we live, and live very well because Dan saw to that part of it before he went to prison. We are considered very proper people, Teresa and myself. Dan sacrificed a great deal for that consideration.
I think that you've sacrificed a great deal yourself, Mrs. Valentine.
When I go back to the hospital to see him tonight, he'll probably tell me to pack my bag and go home, that there's nothing to worry about.
But there is something to worry about, isn't there, Mrs. Valentine? He won't talk about it, and you won't talk about it, and both of you know all about it.
Oh, Mr. Dollar, you're a very young man. I'm sorry if I sound like I could help you. I can't. Please go.
I went back to my hotel and had some dinner. Then after a while, I put in a phone call to the hospital and found out I could talk to Dan Valentine between 7:30 and 9. About then, a special delivery came for me. It contained the information I wanted regarding the policy on Dan Valentine. I noticed that the beneficiary was a dual affair, wife and daughter, Ann and Teresa Ward. I had to check with Inspector DeBaca just once more. No luck. He had been unable to identify or locate the two killers described by the witness. He was trying to trace the car. 7:30 on the dot, I was at the hospital. The reception desk seemed reluctant to talk and referred me to the head nurse who happened to be out to dinner, who referred me to the surgical nurse who took me aside and told me to find a crystal ball.
Mr. Valentine's gone. We have no idea where.
How could he be gone?
We started to give him a transfusion. He jumped up suddenly, knocked down one of the male nurses, grabbed his clothes and ran out of the hospital. Just as simple as that.
I thought he was in a serious condition.
Shh, keep your voice down. He was in a serious condition, and it's going to be critical pretty soon. Running around town bleeding from two bullet wounds. If you want to keep him alive, Mr. Dollar, you better find him and find him fast.
I thought over what Dan Valentine had told me in the hospital earlier about taking care of the matter himself. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized he was going to do just that, even if it killed him.
There'll be another intriguing episode in our story of the Valentine matter tomorrow.
Tomorrow, what happens to a 30-year-old grudge when somebody explains it with bullets? Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, on Tuned to Yesterday from November 1st, 1955 on CBS. Actor Marvin Miller was heard in that episode as the Doctor, and during its golden era, he was one of radio's most famous and most employed announcers, most popularly heard on the Whistler radio series, and in the year of that same broadcast, took on more acting roles, primarily on Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, and the Family Theater. This is an hour of series on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. We move on now with Episode 2 of The Adventures of Marco Polo, a syndicated recording from 1940.
We now present The Adventures of Marco Polo. Marco Polo, intrepid adventurer and explorer. A man who discovered a myriad of strange things in various parts of the world. A man whose stories were disbelieved in the 13th century when he lived. But explorers in latter years proved that Marco Polo had spoken the truth. At the age of 18, Marco Polo was a pleasure-loving, carefree youth who contemplated marriage with a frivolous girl named Giuliana Vecchi. Marco Polo's father, Niccolo, and his uncle, Matthew, desired the young man to take a journey to Persia, but he refused. Marco Polo defied his uncle and his father, and he decided to elope with Giuliana. On the night when the elopement was planned, Marco Polo went with his servant to the steps of Giuliana's home in Venice. And as the gondola drew alongside, Marco Polo was roughly seized, and he heard the voice of his father ordering that he be bound by ropes, and he was told that in spite of himself, he was to be taken to Persia. Hours later, the young man found himself on a vessel, securely bound to a bunk in one of the cabins. Then the door opened and his father entered.
So, father, you have come at last. I demand to be released.
Marco, my son, know you that I have a father's love for you. And because of that love, I must help you to find your manhood.
Where are you taking me?
You are at present on one of my own vessels, bound for the port of Beirut, from whence you commence your overland journey to Persia.
What sort of a father are you to send your son to certain death? Why do you desire to be rid of me? Why do you thwart me in my search of happiness?
Know you, Marco, that I would not ask you to go where I will not go. You must learn to bear the burden of your responsibility, to be proud of your Venetian birthright. I am coming with you to Persia.
You are coming with me.
Even so. And I'm ashamed to think that my son is a coward, afraid to face the dangers of the unknown.
Today was to have been my wedding day. But for your interference, I would have been married to Giuliana Vecchi by now.
A woman who is not worthy of your love.
You have not the right to say that. Bid them release me from my bonds. Bid them turn the vessel about. I will be no son to you.
Marco, you are my son. And for the sake of your mother whom I loved, you shall find your manhood. You shall learn that life is not all idle pleasure.
I know that this scheme was hatched by my uncle Matthew, the sour-faced old scoundrel. He would not dare brave this visit to Persia.
You will see. Matthew, will you come into this cabin?
I come now, brother.
So, my uncle Matthew is aboard the vessel.
Well, Marco Polo, it seems that you are a prisoner.
Do you return to Venice with this vessel, or do you cross the land with us to Persia, my uncle?
I come with you to Persia. When I was your age, I journeyed to many strange lands with your father. I am ashamed that his son is a coward.
You shall not call me coward. No one shall call me a coward.
Marco, my son, a coward is a man who cannot subdue himself. Now bid me cut these bonds. Tell me that you will be my friend, that you will share with us the dangers of this expedition.
Oh, I am so ill. I am not used to the motion of the ship. I fear that I am about to die.
Oh, you will not die. See, my son, I cut the bonds which bind you.
And by cutting those bonds, you seek my friendship. That you shall not have. I am your prisoner now. But the day will come when I will return to Venice to marry the lady of my choice.
Nephew, you are a fool, gulled by laughing eyes and a pretty face. But mayhap in your travels, reason will return to you.
Ah.
Turn not away from your father.
Speak not to me. Oh, I am dying. Would that the vessel would sink beneath me. I am in agony.
You but feel the pangs of seasickness, my son. On the morrow, you shall feel better. We shall leave you now. But remember, all this is being done for your sake.
The sea grew rougher, and Marco Polo was ill and miserable. After a few days, however, the vessel found its way to calm waters, and the young man began to feel considerably better. Then he appeared on deck, where he was greeted by his servant Benno.
Marco Polo, my master, I am glad to set eyes on you.
Why, Benno, you old rascal! What are you doing on this vessel? Why have you not been in attendance upon me?
By your father's orders, a stranger was placed in attendance on you. I believe you have been very ill.
Oh, so ill that I thought I was about to die. Where is my father?
He stands below with the master of the vessel. They are partaking of food.
Strangely enough, I am hungry, Benno. But tell me, what are you doing here? Are you also going to Persia?
Your father said that I was to accompany you to Persia.
Oh, Benno, is there not some way in which we may escape from this vessel? I must find some way to return to Venice.
Oh, Marco Polo, how can you return to Venice? Why do you quarrel with your father? He is a fine man, and he wishes you well.
But he shall not bend me to his will. I am enjoying the fresh air of the sea breeze.
All the Polos are great travelers. Do you not feel the call of strange lands?
No, I wish to return to Venice.
Oh, what a pity, Marco Polo. Strange sights are to be seen. Eastern princes, beautiful princesses.
Did you say beautiful princesses?
Oh, I believe the princesses of the East are of a matchless beauty. And you are well favored, Marco Polo.
Well, I have been admired by fair women.
But no women as fair as you see in Persia.
Oh, I wish to return to Venice. Seek not to tempt me, Benno.
Oh, I do not seek to tempt you, Marco Polo. But I have heard your father and your uncle tell many strange tales of the wonders they have beheld. Great castles built of gold and silver.
And beautiful maidens clad in silks and rare satins.
Diamonds, rubies, emeralds to feast the eyes upon.
Strange sights. You know, Benno, there was a time when I lay ill, when I thought that as soon as I had the strength, I would come up here and hurl myself into the sea. But since listening to you, I like the idea of traveling, seeing strange lands, meeting strange people.
The desire to travel, to explore, is in your blood, Marco Polo. Go then, seek out your father. Tell him that you will go willingly to Persia. There are many dangers to be faced, many adventures which will befall you.
Dangers and adventures. Something stirs within my blood. I will tell you a secret, Benno. Perhaps in my heart of hearts, I shall enjoy this visit to Persia. But my father and my uncle must not know. They will not think that they have bent me to their will.
You are right. They must never know, Marco Polo. But you will not make yourself miserable. You will strive to enjoy this experience.
I will enjoy it, I know, but now I am hungry. I have not eaten real food for many days.
Oh, go below, Marco Polo. When you come to the first door on your right, you will find food which will satisfy your hunger.
Very well, I shall go to eat. Remember, not a word to my father or my uncle.
No.
They will not think that they have tamed me, remember?
Benno, you have done well.
Master Niccolo, did you hear what Marco Polo said?
We heard. Did we not, Matteo?
We heard. We were behind that awning. And I'm beginning to think that mayhap Marco Polo is not as bad as I thought.
He is a Polo. He has the blood of adventurers in his veins, Matteo. We shall yet live to be proud of him.
We must not be too sure. He is proud and stubborn.
But he must not let us know that we have tamed him.
Oh, my heart is happy, brother. Marco Polo will not fail us.
That remains to be proved. We shall see what we shall see.
Marco Polo began to take an interest in his surroundings, and gradually he became very friendly with his father and his uncle. At long last, they reached the port of Beermouth. Then beasts of burden were procured, and native bearers, and the little party started their long journey overland to Persia. For many days they traveled across the trackless desert, till at last they came within sight of a huge castle built high on the side of a mountain. Marco Polo walked with his father and his uncle at the head of the little procession. And then suddenly, Niccolo Polo called a halt.
Oh, we will stop here. Look you, Matteo. See that castle on the mountain?
Yes, a castle of ill repute.
Why, it is the biggest castle I have ever seen.
built behind a veritable wall of rock. What prince lives there, Father?
A prince by the name of Loredan. He is better known as the Old Man of the Mountain.
By all reports, a wild and lawless prince.
We have traveled these many days without seeing other human beings than our servants. I crave for some adventure.
Oh, patience, Marco. We will meet with adventure soon enough.
I thought we would have excitement on this voyage instead of this tiresome traveling by day and night.
Well, let us proceed upon our way.
A moment. First, let us question Benno. He speaks the language of these people. He will know the story of the Old Man of the Mountain. Come forward, Benno.
I come, Master Mario.
That castle is owned by the Prince of Lowerden.
Yes. The bearers tell me he is a wealthy prince who keeps a large army. He makes his wealth by robbing passers-by. We would do well to go around the foot of that mountain, my masters. If we fall into the hands of Prince Aloadin, he will rob us of our goods and show no mercy.
Tell me more about this, Prince Benno. How is it you know these many things?
Oh, I have made many trips with your father before. This prince is known as the Old Man of the Mountain.
Oh?
He holds that mountain fortress against all comers. It is said that the interior of the castle is built of gold, silver, and precious stones.
Precious stones?
All treasures which have been robbed from travelers. They say that the Khan of Persia has tried many times to bring about the downfall of the Old Man of the Mountain, but always he has failed.
Would the Khan of Persia be grateful to us if we brought about the downfall of the Old Man of the Mountain?
Oh, in truth, he would be grateful, but we are a small party. How could we bring about the downfall of the Old Man of the Mountain?
Rave not, Marco. We do not wish to make enemies. We wish to make friends.
Come, let us proceed with our journey.
See? Armed horsemen are approaching us.
We are being surrounded.
Adventures at last.
These men wear the green turbans. They are the soldiers of the Old Man of the Mountain. This means that we shall all die.
Stand fast. We will not show fear.
The Adventures of Marco Polo on Tuned to Yesterday from 1940. Coming up next, it's Firefighters, a syndicated episode marking number 8 in the 140-episode series from November 23, 1949.
Five bells. Stand by all stations.
Attention, all districts. A five-alarm fire, five bells. Move in immediately.
That's it. Let's roll. Let's go. Firefighters. Presenting Firefighters. The true-to-life story of our unsung heroes who stand ready to ride by day or night against our most murderous enemy, the demon of fire. In just a minute, we'll join Tim Collins, rookie fireman, in his wild dash to the scene of his first real fire. Let's go, firefighters! Let's go to the fire department headquarters, where Chief Cody has just assigned Tim Collins to the hook and ladder company of his choice, the famous old Three Ones Company. Tim has his boots, helmet, and firefighter's coat. He's all ready to report to Three Ones at 4 o'clock sharp for duty with the second platoon when suddenly the call bell at headquarters begins to ring.
Hold it, Collins. That's the third alarm.
Box 3-2, that's Clark and Montague in the warehouse district.
And the third alarm from that box, the headquarters company turns out. What in blazes is keeping?
Oh, there they go, Chief.
Yeah, that's more like it. 30 seconds can make all the difference when a fire threatens to get out of control.
Yes, sir. Sir, may I be dismissed on a second? Old 3-1 is due to roll for an alarm at Clark and Montague, and that was a third.
And the third alarm means the battalion chief needs extra help. Get over there, Collins, as fast as you can move. Report for duty at the scene of the fire.
Hey, stop that car. Pull in here, quick.
raising your voice at me, young man?
This is an emergency. Oh, sorry, ma'am. I'd better get a man to drive me. This may be a dangerous run.
A man? Bob, climb in here, Tim Collins.
Huh? Oh, Miss Braddock. Get me to Clark and Montague. There's a fire out of control.
Jump in here, quick.
Yes, sir.
We'll turn at this corner.
Yes, sir. Take it easy, Miss Braddock.
Don't you tell me how to drive, Tim Collins. I was driving my own car before they ever enrolled you in my class at Northside School. Careful now, don't hit my elbow.
Oh, sorry. Just getting into my boots. Now to get my jacket off.
Throw it in the back seat. I'll take care of it for you.
All right. If you'd leave it at the firehouse, you know all three ones.
I'll leave it on my way home. Now, you just wiggle into that rubber coat.
Yes, I'm all set.
Then hold on. Only six more blocks to go.
Uh-huh. Miss Braddock, pull over. Pull over to the curb.
Nonsense. That siren is clearing the way for it.
Let them get by. That's a salvage squad.
Watch me beat them to Clark and Montague.
No, ma'am. Pull over. Get out of their way.
Oh. Tim Collins, I could cry. I could have beaten them to the fire just as easily.
Look, Miss Braddock, fire equipment gets the right of way. Don't ever forget that.
Oh, well, I suppose you're right.
Many a department driver has wrecked his truck and injured good men who were needed at the scene of a fire to avoid hitting a civilian car.
Look there. What a crowd.
Oh, yes. Well, try to work your car through that crowd, Miss Braddock. Careful. That's right. Keep your horn going.
It's that warehouse, Tim.
Uh-huh.
Oh, what a big one.
Yes, ma'am. Four stories. The third, that's the fire floor. See, they're shooting streams through the window.
Fire? Why, it seems to be all at this end of the building.
Well, it's hard to tell, Miss Braddock. A third alarm, it must look bad inside. Well, here's the fire line. All right, thanks a million, Miss Braddock. You can leave my uniform at the firehouse.
All right, Tim. Good luck.
Private Collins, sir. Reporting for duty with the Hook and Ladder Company 111.
I'm Lieutenant Kennedy. Glad to have you with us, Collins. You're just in time. We're pulling out the first platoon.
Kennedy! Lieutenant Kennedy!
Over here, Chief Cody.
Oh, there you are.
Where's the battalion chief? Directing the engine men with the hoses at the front of the building, sir.
What's the situation?
Fire out of control in the third story of this warehouse, Chief. In the front, toward the street, and working backwards through the building.
The building is a whole block long. You ventilated the roof, of course.
We opened the roof over the front of the building. But there's a maze of partitions on that third floor.
So gases and smoke are building up, huh?
We've got to open the roof near the rear.
Hmm? You need more ladders?
Not yet, sir. There's a fire stairway up the rear to the roof. I have a truckman up there now with an axe. I'm just sending this rookie to relieve him.
Private Collins, you know what to do?
Yes, Chief. I'm to open up the roof to let the gas and smoke escape so the men can get in with the hoses and see what they're doing. Without risk of suffocation.
Give him his orders, Lieutenant.
Collins, take the can opener. There's metal sheathing on that roof.
Yes, sir.
That's a bigger can opener than you ever saw in your mother's kitchen, boy.
Yes, sir.
Big enough to rip open this warehouse roof. Now get up there and relieve Private Murphy. And watch yourself going past the third floor. That door may be ready to blow out.
Black as night in here. I gotta unsling my flashlight. There. Yes, sir, there's the stairs. Second floor. Now let's look at that door. Oh, good, a metal fire door. Well, if that's what the door's like up above on the third floor, well, it should hold for a while longer. Gotta watch it, though. Who's down there?
Engine company! Coming in with the hose! Who are you?
Collins! Hook and Ladder, 3-1s!
Any smoke?
No smoke, not here, not yet.
Hey,
floor. Man, it's hot. Well, that door is open. No, it isn't. Better see if it's holding. Better feel, see if it's... Oh, man, that's hot. Hey, you below, you with the hose. Watch this door, it's hot. There's smoke and gas piling up behind it. When she lets go, she'll blow out like a cannon shot.
Okay, Hooksy, we'll watch it.
I'd better watch it myself. No place for Mrs. Collins' boy, Jim. Fourth floor. Door holding fast. Now, let's see. It's hot, but not scorching. Must have filled with gas and smoke from the other end of the building. We gotta let it out through the roof before the fire mushrooms. Oh, now, what's up above? Stairs go up to a penthouse on the roof. What's his name? Murphy. Yeah, Murphy left the door open. I can see daylight. The glass window's in the side. When that fire door lets go, we'll need all the ventilation there is. Yeah, there. That ought to do it. That old can opener opens the windows as well as the roof. Hey, what? Oh, good grief, the fire door. The fire door let go. Come on, Collins, pull yourself together. Get up off your hands and knees. You gotta open up this roof. Oh, smoke is thicker up here. Let's see. Collins, smoke coming up through the roof over there. That's where... What's his name? Murphy. That's where Murphy smashed the skylight with his axe.
Murphy, sound off. Here's your relief.
Oh. What's that now? Oh, an axe. Murphy dropped it.
Hey, Murphy. Murphy, sound off. I can't see you.
Oh. Oh, good grief. Here he is. He's out cold. The smoke must have knocked him out.
Does Tim have his hands full, or doesn't he? Ordered to the roof of the burning warehouse to break a hole in the metal roofing with a giant can-opener device, Tim Collins, rookie fireman, seeks the man he is supposed to relieve at this important task. He finds him lying helpless, overcome with smoke. But Tim knows what to do, as you'll hear in our next true-to-life episode of The Firefighters. And now Chief Bob Cody with a special assignment for all young firefighters. Chief Cody.
Hello, boys and girls. This is your friend Chief Cody with an important assignment for you. Attention, firefighters. You are to inspect your homes for these special fire hazards. Cleaning fluid that is not carefully confined in a bottle or can with a tight cover, paint in cans whose lids are not tightly closed, and rags or cleaning cloths that have been stored carelessly. Remember, the fumes of cleaning fluid and paint are dangerous. A spark is enough to cause an explosion, and cleaning cloths don't need a spark. They can catch fire through spontaneous ignition when not properly stored. Now inspect your home for these fire hazards. That is all, and goodbye for now.
Fire Chief Cody and his young rookie fireman, Tim Collins, will be back tomorrow at the same time on the same station when you hear...
That's it. Let's roll!
Firefighters on Tuned to Yesterday, Episode 8, a syndicated recording from November 22, 1949. We close out this hour of series on Tuned to Yesterday with Episode Number 2 of The Man in the Iron Mask from 1948.
The Man in the Iron Mask. Already we have heard of the amazing significance in Europe of the Man in the Iron Mask.
In fact, nobody ever knew his name. Yet many were prepared to put forward theories as to his identity. The man in the iron mask lived and died in the 18th century. And in this 20th century, one beautiful summer's morning, Michael and Louise Dent, honeymooning on their yacht off the coast of France, suddenly come upon the island where the man in the iron mask had been imprisoned. During their inspection of the fortress, Michael has been accidentally locked in the rooms of the man in the iron mask. He does not reply when his wife calls from the other side of the door.
Why don't you answer? Michael! Michael!
Monsieur! What is the matter in there?
Oh, something's happened in the room. I never wanted to come near this hateful place, but Michael insisted. Oh, quickly, monsieur, you must open the door.
But it is not matter.
Well, surely there's another key. Michael! Michael!
There is a key downstairs. I will go and get it at once, madame. You will come too?
No, no, I'm staying here. But hurry, please, hurry, monsieur. Oh, goodness knows what's happened inside there. Oh, Michael, why don't you answer? What happened to you?
Hurrying down the stairs, the old caretaker took some time to find the duplicate key of the prison rooms of the man in the iron mask. But eventually he was back again with this second key on a great ring. Louise, white-faced, tight-lipped, stood aside quickly as he pushed the great key into the lock.
I feel almost afraid now. Almost afraid to walk inside there.
Enter, madame.
Michael! Michael!
The room. It is empty.
Then he must be in the other room. Oh, good heavens, this room is empty too.
Mon Dieu.
But surely he couldn't have... Oh, no, not through the window. A terrible drop to the sea below.
It would be impossible for him to climb through the windows, madame. Look at the iron bars.
But there's no other way out. Monsieur Nicholas, there's no other way out. He must be here.
But he is not, madame. It brings fear to my heart. Remember, I told you that I've been strange tales of these rooms and the man in the iron mask.
Oh, don't talk like that. He must be here somewhere. Perhaps he's behind this writing desk.
It could hardly hide behind that, madame. Let us leave this room, madame. He is not here.
But there must be some other way out. Perhaps a secret door, a secret panel.
Madame, did I not tell you that when the man in the iron mask died, all the walls of these rooms were washed, all his personal belongings burned, and even his flagstones were taken up and examined underneath? There is no other exit from this room.
But that's absurd. He couldn't just disappear.
Madame, are you quite sure that he was inside the room when the door automatically locked? As you know, the passage was dim. The candles were blown out at the top of the stairs. Perhaps he was outside all the time.
Yes, that seems to be the only explanation, monsieur. Either that or else I'm going crazy. And yet I'm sure I saw him on the other side of the door before it closed. Oh, dear heaven, my head is going round and round. I don't know what I saw now. I don't know what I'm saying. Monsieur, we've got to find him. We must search the fortress through and through. You've got to help me. I must find my husband.
So the search began. Every room, every passageway, the battlements and turrets, and finally the dungeons underneath. Oozing with slime. Nicholas had a plan of the fortress, and the job was done methodically. But there was no sign of Michael Dent. Now the sun was sinking, and a quick darkness was spreading across the sky and over the island itself, turning the lush green and the brown rocks into sinister and menacing shadows. And finally a great fire was lit on the beach, and by this fire Louise sat waiting, hoping against hope that her husband would see its brightness and come to her. And all this time her thoughts flew to the two rooms in the fortress and the fact that they belonged to the man in the iron mask. This strange person who lived in his seclusion in the middle of the 18th century. Towards 3 a.m, there was a movement in the darkness and Louise sprang to her feet. But soon the leaping flames of the fire showed the face of Monsieur Nicholas. Louise hurried towards him.
You have news, monsieur?
I am sorry, madame. There is no news. But my wife, she insists that you come to our quarters. There is coffee waiting for you.
Oh, thank you, monsieur. You're very kind.
Take my arm, madame. Although I have a lantern, it is dark and the path is very rough. Madame, I have been talking with my wife. She has decided that she will not stay here any longer. Tonight, it is a finish.
She was frightened before?
Very frightened. As I told you earlier in the day, she believes that the rooms of the man in the iron mask are haunted. She firmly believes that he revisits the scenes of his torment.
Oh!
Just a moment. Keep still. Keep perfectly still.
What's the matter?
In the undergrowth there, I heard the snapping of a twig. Just a moment while I raise my lantern.
Are you there, Louise?
Michael!
Monsieur Ted!
Oh, Michael! Michael, where have you been? Oh, darling, what happened to you? I've been nearly out of my mind with worry.
When did you disappear? We have been searching frantically.
Oh, I didn't realize it was so late. Michael. The time has gone so quickly, and I was so absorbed in...
In what?
Never mind. Oh, darling, when I looked at the time and I discovered how late it was...
Where have you been? What does this all mean, Michael?
I'll tell you later. Not now.
Not now? Why are you being so mysterious? Darling, don't you understand? I've been almost frantic.
The old island has been beside itself, monsieur. Oh, but this is wonderful news. I must hurry and tell my wife. Bring him with you, madame. The coffee I promised. Perhaps we will learn more then.
Darling, what is all this?
I don't want to say anything in front of that Frenchman, but I have discovered something, Louise. Something that might rock France from border to border.
But what is it?
Let's have our coffee. Then I'll take you to the rooms of the man in the iron mask.
Michael Dent's silence over coffee made the old caretaker's wife more nervous than she had been before. She was convinced that this man had had some visitation from the past and was frightened to speak of it. And later, when Captain Balling had been given no explanation either, he too had his reactions, but they were reactions of anger. He felt that Michael Dent had been playing some practical joke. But later, much later, with the first light of dawn, when everybody was asleep, Michael roused his wife, and together they climbed the stone steps of the fortress and into its cavern-like interior, and to the suite of the man in the iron mask. Louise gave a frightened gasp as he walked inside and locked the door.
There's no need to worry, darling. There's nothing to be afraid of. Nothing of the supernatural, is this what you're thinking? The door is locked. We will be uninterrupted. As you know, Louise, I was so interested in that lock because it was like one of our modern ones. The automatic fixtures and the workmanship. And then I noticed on this side of the door, this ornamentation in the shape of a bull. See, this side of the lock, just where you push the key in.
Oh, yes, Michael.
Well, then I happened to look above the door. There. Just above the middle of the door, on the wall, see?
The frieze to match.
Yes. More ornamentation in the shape of bulls. But that one above the door is different somehow. It's made of the same metal as this lock, the same color. That is why I pulled up a chair. Why I got on the chair so I could examine it more closely. And then the wonderful thing happened. I placed my hand on the metal. There seemed to be some kind of movement, and look.
Good heavens, Michael, it moved.
Yes, a secret door, Louise. And of all places, above the original door. Who would ever think of finding a door above a door?
Oh, this is extraordinary.
Do you blame me when I scrambled up there? I was so excited, I had no thought of anything else.
But didn't you hear me call?
No, but I thought you had gone for the key. When I climbed up inside into that room up above, the panel shut and I couldn't open it again. I waited for you to come into the room, but heard nothing, so I started exploring.
Well, I couldn't get in because the key was inside.
Yes, I discovered that later. Anyhow, my discovery.
What did you find up there?
Better come up and see for yourself, my dear. Then you'll understand why I've said nothing. Here, let me help you.
Yes.
This table is much higher than the chair, if you can manage that with my help.
Yes, Michael. Oh, it's all so odd. The rooms of the man in the iron mask. Surely he didn't use this room, too. And if he did, to what purpose?
You'll see. Now, see. Now, stay up there, my dear. I can manage quite easily.
What a strangely furnished room.
Furnished as all rooms were furnished in 1760 or thereabouts.
1760?
Something like that. This desk. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, yes.
I wiped the thick dust away there, but the rest, as you can see, is covered in grime, half an inch thick.
Michael, what's that?
I was waiting for you to see it.
Oh, how hideous. Oh, what a horrible face.
You know what it is?
The mask. The iron mask.
Yes, darling. It's your privilege and mine to look at something that hasn't been seen for nearly 300 years.
Michael.
This dreadful instrument which locked a man away from the world. And here, by this instrument, is the secret which all Frenchmen have been seeking. The life story of the man in the iron mask. Who he was, what he did, and why he was imprisoned here in this fortress.
Oh, Michael.
Sit down, darling. Now you'll understand why I forgot where I was, what was happening. Why I forgot time and place and even my lovely wife. Sit and listen while I read an amazing story from this faded diary. The secret of the man in the iron mask.
So Michael and Louise Dent have stumbled across an amazing secret in this extraordinary room. At their feet is the hideous, grinning contraption known as the Iron Mask. And now in Michael's hands is a faded book with even more faded writing. The Secret of the Man in the Iron Mask.
The Man in the Iron Mask, on Tuned to Yesterday, Episode 2 from the syndicated series released in 1948. And that does it for this hour of continuing series on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next week at the same time as we continue these great stories from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Livonia. It's been a pleasure.